The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. This morning I'm going to talk about finding and walking the way of the Buddhas and walking our own way, finding our own way within that. And how can that be that we find our own way within a way that is the walking of the way of the Buddhas and the ancestors? It turns out that they're one and the same, but we have to find that out first before we can know that. And that's one of the big points of walking our own way, is that this is a way that is born out of our own experience. It's not a way that we can conceptualize or intellectualize. And what I want to do today is to start with the verse that struck me as we just had the ceremony of the festival memorial for remembering all the people that have died or have been affected by wars. And what I want to bring to our talk today is two people that I've run across that have been very helpful to me in my own finding of the way. And it's a different perspective, a different part of the world, but it's still people like us who had to contend with conditions that were really difficult. And the two people that I'm going to talk about a little bit are, one is Aoyama Roshi, who's a Japanese nun, still alive. And the other one is Uchiyama Roshi, who is, both of them were born in Japan. I thought it would be fitting to talk about them because we just did the ceremony that we just did. Because I didn't realize this, but both of them lived through the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. They were alive at the time. Uchiyama Roshi was 33, and Aoyama Roshi was 12. And they both lived within, I figured, about 800 miles away from Nagasaki, which was the northernmost town that was bombed closest to them. So, their lives were not easy. However, for me, that's quite an inspiration that they became Buddhist Zen masters in their own time and were able to pass on the teaching that they found from their own experience and pass it on to us. I found a definition of what I thought was a good one for what might be helpful. And what does that mean to find our way? Finding the way as the ungraspable essential truth born out of our experience, of which the teaching of the Buddha sprung, and which is accessible in the realization of one's own immediate experience. So what this is talking about is not something that is isn't tangible. It's something that we can actually understand. It is something that we can connect with because it's our own experience that we're looking for, what we're looking for, that is so deeply satisfying to find. And that is to walk the way of the Buddhas and the ancestors, and to make it our own way as well at the same time. What we can't do is we can't follow in the footsteps of somebody else. We can find examples, we can find inspiration from other people, but we have to do the walking ourselves. And this is one of the things I want to emphasize, is that we have to do the walking. Nobody's going to do it for us. We get lots of help, lots and lots of help. Some of the help we really could do without, we think, Because it's something unwelcome or something we just don't want to hear. And that leads me to some teachings that Yama Roshi learned. So I'm going to talk about Aoyami Roshi's life a little bit and then about Uchiyama Roshi's life a little bit. So Aoyama Roshi was, like I said, she was 12 years old when the bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And from the age of 5, she lived in a monastery. So she had a good start. She was born in a Buddhist country that had been devastated by war. So it was a difficult situation. But was living in a monastery from 5 onward. She's still a monk or a nun. They called her nuns at her monastery. She stuck it out. She had determination. She had something inside of her that she needed to express in her life. And what that something was her own understanding of what the Buddha's way meant. And it wasn't anybody else's, it was hers. But she learned from other people. When she came to the monastery, she was, like I said, 5 years old. And she had two teachers there at the monastery that she went to. And she learned something. She learned all that she knew about Buddhism in an experiential way from these two teachers. But they were very skillful in teaching her. And she's deeply grateful. And to this day, from her writings, I can tell that she still offers them lots of merit out of the gratitude for all that they gave her. One of the things that happened was that she had a chance to go to the university because she was a bright young woman. And she went there full of lots of ideals and aspiration of how to live the Buddha's way. She felt like she knew, like some 16-year-olds can really think they know it all. Well, she was one of them. And so she was going off to the university, and her two teachers just, they were strict with her. And they said, "Just how great a teacher do you think you are?" She thought she was pretty great. "Everybody has some good points. If you don't have the modesty of heart to be able to learn from any and everyone, what are you going to do?" And this struck her deeply. And for years and years, she carried this teaching and was able to see the good intent that was there, which is a gift. She didn't take it as something negative and run away, but there was something in her that needed to find the Buddha's way and to express it in her own life. And what she says about this is, she writes in this book, which I think a lot of you are familiar with, Zen Seeds. And this is the only book that I found that she has written in English. She's written quite a bit in Japanese, but this is what we have from her in English. So after these words about, you know, what are you going to do? Everybody has a good heart, you know, and you need to find that in every situation. She says, "Even now those words echo in my ears. The 15 years of my youth spent in the university and vainly seeking the way had been like following an endlessly curving mountain road." Nice image. So you never kind of get anywhere, right? With an endlessly curving road. You can't see where you're going, but you're really not kind of getting anywhere that is where you think you ought to be. "In spite of that, I finally made my path. With a new sense of admiration for the profundity and splendor of the way, I was able to return to our mountain temple in search of spiritual growth." So she was able to say yes to that strict teaching and not know what to do with it necessarily, but have the patience and the meditation to sit with it and the faith to be able to say, there's something here for me. She had a trust of her teacher. She had a trust of the Buddha's teaching enough that she could act on that faith. By acting on that faith, she just didn't, it wasn't like she had a pathway that was open up and clear to her, but it was something that, there was something very deep and profound that she could listen to and respond to. Something I found is really helpful is we're trying to find our way, and for whatever reason, we're all trying to find our way. Whether we're trying to find it because we want to get away from a situation, we're sick of what we're doing, we're trying to find a cause for suffering, we're trying to understand what the Buddha's way is, all sorts of different reasons that we try to find our way. And what I have found is that there are things that our hearts will respond to if we hear them sometimes. Lots of things. We have a tremendous legacy from the Buddhist time and from 25 centuries of Buddhism being taught by people who were very dedicated and devoted to living their lives out in the way. And what I think is a helpful suggestion, and what I do, is I'll be listening to scriptures, or I will be reading something of the Dharma, and something will just pop up, and I'll go, oh, I didn't understand that like that before. And I think a lot of people have known this sort of response. Or you see it in a new light. And what the teaching is that I think of learning how to walk our way is to not just say, oh, that's nice, whatever that means, but to keep going and saying, well, turn toward that, to actually turn toward that. What is it that sparked our interest? What is it that, what response was it there that came up for us? And why did it happen? You know, that is a pathway. And in my mind, that's how we find our own way, is turning towards that which our heart responds to, because that's just what it is. These things come out of the blue all the time for me anyway. I don't know. I think it's a pretty common sort of thing for people who study or who are looking for things that the heart really can respond to and find a way to walk that way. So turning towards that is one way of saying, hey, this has got my attention. Why is that? You know, what is it that I'm looking at here? Why am I, why did that get me? Why did that come up at all anyway? But if we can turn towards that and look in that direction of where it came from, and investigate it and see what's there for us. Because I can guarantee that you all that there is something that is there that we would like to hear, some good teaching on how to help ourselves out of our suffering. And here's another story from Aoyama Roshi's early life. She was 5 years old, a little girl. And her teacher, they had a statue of Amida Buddha on the altar. And one of her teachers, she had two of them, said, you see the Amida Buddha statue on the altar? Well, look at his hands. They're in circles. Because I believe the mudra for the Amida Buddha is something like this. I'm not quite sure. I should have looked it up. But it's circles. You know, that's upside down, but you can get the idea. And she says, you look at the Amida Buddha and see if his hands are in circles. And that's the way it's supposed to be. But if they're in triangles, he may not be very happy. This is a 5-year-old girl they're talking to. And he said, no matter where you are, this is what the teacher said, no matter where you are, whether asleep or awake, or even if you completely forget about the Buddha, he is always watching over you. So this is what she heard And so over the years, she developed a trust she found a lot of trust and promise in those words. And she used that image of the Buddha statue saying, well, does the Buddha have his hands in a circle or in a triangle? And over time, she was able to really connect with that teaching because she found it helpful. And not helpful that she was a good little girl, but more that there was something in her that responded at that young age that she found helpful. And she says, no matter how hard I tried, there were times when I misunderstood, reproached, or felt hemmed in on all sides. It was at these times that I felt embraced by the warmth emanating from Amida Buddha's hands and did not feel alone. Out of this teaching, she says, my wish was that no matter how I appeared in the eyes of worldly people, I wanted to live my life in a way that Amida Buddha approved of. In other words, she learned a great lesson. She learned the importance of living according to the Buddha's ways. That was the measuring stick rather than how other people thought of her. And that's a great lesson to learn. And she says that she's very grateful for learning such a lesson at such a young age. And she carried that throughout her life, living according to what we would call the three treasures, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, or the Buddhist teachings. And I ask myself, and maybe I will ask you, how do you align yourself with the triple treasure in your daily life? You know, can we extend that out a little bit so that it is more open to suggestion of how is that possible? Or is it even possible? I'll leave that up to you. We hear the teaching, we're the ones that have to walk the way. And it's doable. She also learned at the same time that a life interwoven with joy, anger, sadness, and pleasure by happiness and unhappiness is itself in the very palm of the Buddha's hand. I was able to receive these two teachings in the first stage of my life. I feel that the years since have been spent confirming those teachings through practice. So she took that up. She turned towards that teaching. She took that up and has carried it for, I don't know how old she is. She's probably in her 80s by now. She has carried that teaching all those years as a way to help her find her way. And that's what we can do. These things became her own experience. They were something that she learned from her teachers as words they spoke, but then they became her own experience. And what I want to also point out was that this is nothing miraculous. You know, we're not talking about great enlightenment experiences. This is kind of what you call daily life, living, presenting us conditions and opportunities to pick up the Buddha Dharma if we so want to. And sometimes I think, just to kind of get a fire going underneath me, I think, well, what would it be like if I met a meditation master like Tendo Nyojo? What if I were like face to face with him? You know, he's dead. He died a long time ago. But, you know, or some other great master that I revere who probably would be intimidated by being in front of. And what a waste it would be if I just said, well, you know, something goofy like, this is nice to meet you, or, you know, something inane, or you have a nice temple here, you know, something like that. But what an opportunity to know, to be in the presence of somebody like that, where you could open to that moment. I think about that. It'd be scary. It could be really scary. I read something that Sawaki Kodo has said. It was a quote. He was a kind of fiery type of monk. And he said, you know, somebody was obviously talking to him, had met him, and said, what are you looking at? Why don't you look at your own mind? You know, something like, so you don't ever know what a Zen master or a meditation master is going to come up with. And that's kind of what life does to it. It just presents us with these situations where we don't know. And do we have enough faith to open our hearts into that moment? Or would you, you know, what if, you know, it'd be sad for me to miss that opportunity. It's just some kind of fleeting, oh, gee, that was nice, a dream that just kind of floated away. But, you know, how would it be to just be open in faith in that moment with somebody like that? And, of course, we can do that all the time because the Buddha's way is always available to us. It's just our matter of our opening to it in our own way. We find our own way through that. So I think I'll move on to Uchiyama Roshi. But first I want to read one of the chapters in here that I dearly love. I have to get this, this thing's massive. Is a story. Aoyama Roshi, she was educated at Kamazawa University and was smart. She learned a lot of about other what other people were doing, poetry, artists, and she drew from their experiences and incorporated that into her teaching. And one of the things that I am reading here now is from just such a experience. This is from the chapter on Walk Straight by Winding Along. Zen Master Genshu Watatabi, in his last years, called to his bedside a monk who had recently become a disciple. The master asked, "How can one go straight up a steep mountain road of 99 curves?" Well, the young disciple said, "I don't know." So this disciple was told, "Walk straight by winding along." And Aoyama Roshi writes after this, "When told to walk straight, we stupidly think we have to cross mountains, hills, rivers, and the sea in a straight line. Ignoring traffic lights, we dash off like a race car, looking neither left nor right. But we only deceive ourselves into thinking we progress as we lurch forward. Instead," she says, "go straight by winding along." I like that. Go straight by winding along. Okay. Now, move to Uchiyama Roshi. His is a very different story. Different person. But again, he was born in 1912, so he was 33 years old when the two atomic bombs went off in Japan. His story starts with being, his father called him controversial person ever since he was a kid. And he learned quickly and learned a lot of different things in his life and has found that what he was learning from people around him wasn't enough. And by that I mean it was too limiting. People around him, like his father, was an expert in origami. And so young Uchiyama learned about origami, but just felt, and he mastered it. He loved it, but he just felt it was too limiting. In Uchiyama's life, when he was in high school, he says, "My eyes were always drawn to a much larger world, and it has always been my dream to come up with some ideas that might be helpful to other people around the world." So this was his way. This was what he started with in high school, never even dreaming about being a monk, not even close. He was an intellectual. But he still had this idea that somewhere what he wanted to do with his life was to help be helpful to other people around the world. And he took it one step further in high school. He said, "Far more serious for me was my concern with the overall theme of my life. This came to be centered on the question of what self is. And this is a theme that he carried throughout his life, spent a lot of time trying to understand what the self is. And this is before his teacher was Sowake Kodo. He didn't even meet Sowake Kodo until he was 30 years old. And search for what the self is became what he later termed the universal self or the whole self. And he says, my life has been dedicated to searching for a way that is connected and, moreover, is the most spiritually refined way for a person to live. Now, this is born out of his experience. In his book, this is where this came out of here. If you're interested in finding out what he means by the most spiritually refined way a person can live, this is where you can find out about that. And what he says now is, what I mean by refining your life is aiming constantly and wholehearted living out the truth of life, not creating some pseudo-elegant lifestyle. So he was very dedicated to this and felt that other people were living superficial lives that were fabrications that weren't really life. It reminds me of Dogen's chapter on the painting of a rice cake. In other words, we conjure up what we think life is, but what really is our life? What is this universal self? So he took that. This was in high school. He had these thoughts. And he also received a higher education at Waseda University in Western philosophy. And 3 years later, he became a monk. And this is how he kind of came about, this whole thing of being a monk. By studying Western philosophy academically, he says, you can pretty much learn what it is all about, but Buddhism is another matter. It is virtually impossible to make much sense of it if you don't actually practice it. So he is thorough. He needed to understand what this meant for him. So to understand Buddhism and Zazen thoroughly, he says, I became a monk. That was all there was to it. My becoming a monk was somewhat of a fabricated means for doing Zazen, because it was easier to do Zazen if I took the lifestyle of a monk. But it never occurred to me that I had to become a monk. What he's saying is that the form of a monk is helpful to understanding what it means, what Buddhism means, right? So he kind of fell into that. I was ordained as a novice monk on December 8th, 1940, which was Pearl Harbor Day in Japan, across the date line from the U.S., so it was a day ahead or day later. I had been an intellectual doing little besides reading and thinking, but I was determined to put all my energy into this practice. So he became a monk after 3 years in 1941, after he graduated from the university. He was 30 years old, and he stayed with Sowake Kodo until Sowake Kodo died in 1965. And just, this is a sense for monks, especially the novices. He was a novice monk until he was 65 years old. That is a long time. Keep that in mind for difficult situations, you know. That's tough. Yeah. And let's see. So Uchiyama's first impression of Sowake Kodo is, it was the first time I had ever encountered a person who spoke clearly about the self for which I had been searching. Although I had listened to a lot of lectures on Buddhism and Christianity, those talks had nothing to do with the self. So, you know, after the war, he said he was extremely poor, like a great many Japanese people, and finally settled down in 1949 at the temple that he stayed in. But throughout all of those times, he said, I continued my search for a true way of life. difficult situations, not easy. And this is another point I just want to bring out, that just because the situations are difficult, it doesn't mean you can't do your training. Just because of these two people's examples of that, and the inspiration for me. What I've been trying to do is, in my life, is explain things in a concrete way that might be understandable and helpful to anyone. I had to look at both Christianity and Buddhism and intellectually at Western philosophy to realize both my self-expression and my life vow of expressing the true meaning of living out the whole self. In other words, he had to go through all those steps he had to go through in order to come to the understanding of the universal self that he wanted to give expression in his life. So I hope this helps you realize that the way is doable. It's not an easy way. It's a wonderful way. It is a way that we can all walk together. And the one of the things I love about this is that we each have to find our own way. We each have to step out, turn towards that, what our heart responds to, walk that way. But in walking that way, we find we're all walking the same way. And there's something that's very wonderful about that. It doesn't take away from my responsibility or anybody else's, but we're all walking the same way together. In other words, we're all turning towards that same direction of walking the way of the Buddhas and ancestors, which is much bigger than our own way. I think I'll leave it at that.